supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Most of us have had to live our lives experiencing an unexpected event. Or if we haven't, odds are we will. It's as though we're walking down the street and all of a sudden there's no sidewalk. And there we are in free fall. So what happens then? How do we move forward without rules, guideposts, expectations? Well, today we're talking about living with that dreaded diagnosis, the news that our lives will be forever changed. How do we live with that? How do we survive and even thrive? Today, we're going to be speaking about a wide range of ... experiences. I'm here in the studio with Dr. Guy Fried. He's chief medical officer at McGee Rehab right here in Philadelphia. Guy, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's good to be with you. We're also going to hear some personal stories about living with. First, we'll hear from Jennifer and Dan Digman, a married couple, both of whom have MS. Jennifer was diagnosed in 1997 and uses a wheelchair. Dan was diagnosed later and is still ambulatory. And we also want to hear from you, of course, 888-477-9499. We want to hear about your experiences in your life and how you've coped or had difficulty coping with them. But first, we're going to Jennifer and Dan Digman. At the risk of being all Hallmarky here, tell me about how you kids met.
Well, you don't want to be Hallmarky, neither do I, but I'll get us started. We both have MS, and we actually were introduced to each other at an MS event back in 2002. She was a project leader.
I was a program leader, and Dan was an attendee. And we sat together and started talking, and we have not quit talking since meeting 12 years ago.
So, you know, I mentioned when I introduced you both, Jennifer, you were diagnosed in 97. So what was happening in your life that led to that diagnosis?
I had graduated from college in May of 97. I got my first, air quote, big girl job, and I was working, and all of a sudden I had double vision. And I went and I saw an ophthalmologist who said that it looked like multiple sclerosis, and this was 6 months after I graduated from college. So I was diagnosed then, and unfortunately I have rather an aggressive form of the disease, and I just quickly started to feel the effects of multiple sclerosis.
It's called secondary progressive, aggressive form. Don't go so fast here, Jennifer. What happened that moment? I mean, look at the timing in your life. What happened to you that moment you heard multiple sclerosis?
That moment, as far as the symptoms or the emotions?
The emotions.
I think I was in tears probably every day from maybe the first week. I just didn't know what I was going to do, and everything I read was very, you know, doomsday is how I felt, and I didn't know who was ever going to want to, you know, I was 23, I wasn't married, I wasn't in a serious relationship, and then those questions of who's going to want to be with a woman who has this disease.
Wait, let me stop you there. Did you feel unlovable because of your disease?
I felt like damaged goods, yeah. To be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Guy, you know, you've had a lot of experiences, and I don't know, as a rehab doc, if you've been in the position of telling people that they have MS or telling people they've got one of these devastating diagnoses, but this kind of self-loathing or harsh critical judgment, or as you know, Jennifer said, damaged goods, and I experienced that. I mean, I didn't feel unlovable. I was quite positive that I was. Is that unusual from what you've seen?
It's not unusual. It certainly, as the physician presents a diagnosis, people hear scary names. They don't even know what it means. You hear multiple sclerosis, and many people who hear it for the first time have no idea of what it is other than it's a dread, and that's when they stop hearing anything. So as a physician, it's to explain what it is and to explain realistically, optimistically, what is it, what can you control about it, what can't you control, and just to get a better sense other than just a label, because labels are scary.
So Jennifer, you met this guy at this conference, and
yes.
And he fell in love with you. Did you think there was something wrong with this guy?
No, I actually thought he was very handsome, but the program was intended for women with multiple sclerosis. So I thought this cute man had to be there with his girlfriend or his wife, and lo and behold, I found out that he had MS, and I thought, oh, wow, we're in the same boat with this disease, and he was very easy to talk to, and it just worked. I mean, I don't know, Dan. For you, it was kind of the same thing, wasn't it?
I think it was. We always joke, because I always say it was love at first sight. I mean, I was just like, I wasn't supposed to be there, but we always joke, too, that they forgot to put on the invitations that it was intended for women only. And so we had one of the program managers for the MS Society call and invite me to go to the event, because I think they were just getting men registering. They needed more to participate. And so I registered and went down there. And when she had suggested I sat at Jennifer's table, just because we were both younger and had, you know, leading self-help groups, that we'd have more stuff to talk about. And interestingly enough, it was just like we had so much to talk about that was not MS-related.
So I want to hear about these, you know, Guy Fried, you know, talked about what it means, and it means something different for everybody. Now, I know, Jennifer, you're in a motorized wheelchair, and you're more dependent. You need more help than Dan does.
Yes, that's true.
And what else besides being in a wheelchair? And what are the other implications?
Well, for me, I have weakness. MS has caused me to be weak on the left side of my body. So I have difficulty with my left arm. I don't use it as often. And, you know, there are certain days when I can't cut up my own food, or I have difficulty styling my hair. Dan does a great job helping me quaff my do. So those things, or I went shopping last week. I was clothes shopping, and I was by myself. My caregiver had walked away, and, you know, when I can't reach something, if my caregiver's not there, I'm relying on the kindness of strangers. Hey, could you grab that for me? Or, you know, so those implications, you just don't realize how many things you take for granted.
Yeah, I'll bet you have found what I have found, that the kindness of strangers is abundant.
It is very abundant.
Yeah. Dan, I want to hear about adaption. Now, you don't have progressive. You've got relapsing, remitting, and you're not in a wheelchair. You're much more independent than Jennifer. You're actually quaffing dews. So my dew could use a little quaffing.
Well, I will give you Dan's phone number. He does a great style.
So tell us how does all this work, you two?
I think it's, it's just part of who we are. I think that there's always the thing that when you get married, there's always the thing of in sickness and in health. And I think if there's an advantage, I mean, we went into it more as like in sickness and in sickness because it's like you kind of had your expectations set when you got into it. I think just knowing what's there. And I think that I guess you don't think about it. It's just you just do. I mean, there's nothing because there's nobody else that will come to your rescue. And how do you help the other person?
I want to ask all three of you, Dan, Jennifer, and Guy Fried about long-term planning here. I mean, with MS and the kind both of you have, it's not going to improve.
It's not going to improve, but certainly we take medication in hopes to lengthen the distance between exacerbations, those moments when our diseases flare up and the symptoms get worse. So, we do take medication, and we are always thinking, we live in a house that, thank God, we were able to find that is fully accessible, and it has the ramps and the roll-in shower. And, we make those modifications in the house, my parents have in their house. So that long range, we have to think about that. And I think, just we try to be mindful of our energy supply. And just, we try not to think about MS, but we do make adjustments and we give it its, be honest, Dan, we have to give it its...
give it its due respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Jennifer and Dan Digman, both diagnosed with MS, seem to be a happily married couple. I'm also here with Dr. Guy Fried, who's the chief medical officer at McGee Rehab here in Philadelphia. Guy, what do you tell people? We're not just talking about MS here. We're talking about living with. So what do you tell people about the long-range picture, not just MS, but we're talking about people who've had strokes or people with cognitive defects or spinal cord injury?
Well, every person is different, and certainly every disease process is different. So we try to work with patients on what a realistic view of the future is. We also assess patients for whatever weaknesses they may have, but whatever strengths they may have to bring to the table, and work with their strengths and see what we can do, perhaps some more therapy or perhaps some more gadgets or perhaps some more technology or some other adjustment will help them maintain their current lifestyle or improve their current lifestyle. So it's constantly reassessing, reprioritizing, and controlling what you can.
I forgot to give out the numbers, but I want to follow up. Numbers 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open, and we would love to hear from you. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'd like to hear about your experience of living with that which you have to live with, but certainly didn't invite it into your lives. Guy, we're hearing great stories from Jennifer and Dan, but there's got to be other factors in there too. So I wonder about insurance. I wonder about support system. I wonder about all that stuff.
All of those are certainly variables. Certainly, insurance is going to be a prime variable. Some people have insurances that will pay for various equipment. Some people have insurances that will pay for no equipment. Some have insurances that will pay for a lot of support services, some that no support services.
And that affects prognosis.
That definitely affects prognosis. If you can't receive what you need, unfortunately, you slip backwards.
That might even affect life expectancy.
Can absolutely affect life expectancy. You need what you need, and sometimes it is knocking on the door of that insurer to re-educate them on what it is. And sometimes with the social workers, you can change the insurance around, or at least debate of what you need and what you don't need.
So I've got to ask you a personal question now, because having this discussion with you at this moment, I feel furious, almost rageful, about what people have to live with and the person next door doesn't have to live with it, just by virtue of insurance companies. And you and your social workers deal with this all day, every day. What happens to you, Guy? I mean, do you have to just close off your emotions here? How do you cope with that?
You try to be as involved as possible, but you try to deal with the facts. I get extremely frustrated, but if I get too frustrated, then I can't help anyone. So I have to try to put the emotions aside and just say, this is what we have to contend with. And there's always some silver rim around it where you can get them a little more therapy or a little more equipment. There are some charitable organizations that can come around. There's Office of Vocational Rehabilitation or Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. If someone is trying to become an independent homekeeper or get back to work, there are state and federal agencies that can help support them in those endeavors.
All right, so you're going to have to talk me down now because I'm still pretty PO'd about what people have
And I understand the frustration, but I have to be positive about it and
say, of course.
These are the cards that have been dealt. What can we do to best play our hand?
Of course. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to go to the phones and start taking calls. We're talking about living with whatever you have to live with, whether it's a terrible diagnosis or any other thing that has just turned your life upside down, and you'll have to live with this for the rest of your life. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your stories. Our number is 888-477-9499. We've been talking with Jennifer and Dan Digman, both of whom have MS. We're talking with Dr. Guy Free, Chief Medical Officer at McGee. And a little later on in the show, we're going to hear from Jessica Keenan-Smith. She's managing editor of a blog called Living with Epilepsy. Well, we'll be back after a very short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voice in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux. Backed by more than 100 years of service to individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and half a century of working directly with children and adults with autism, now provides autism diagnoses for children. Devereaux offers timely appointments in as little as 4 weeks and uses the ADOS-2, the latest of autism assessments. For more information or to request an appointment, devereaux.org. Devereaux is proud to support WHYY.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about living with ongoing or chronic life-altering events. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Russell on the line. Hi, Russell.
How are you?
Good. What can we do for you?
Well, Dr. Gottlieb, I'm a 37-year-old man who had just gone back to school to get a college degree to change his career in life, and a year after graduating, my back started breaking and became permanently disabled. And the longer the injury keeps worsening, the more and more isolated I'm getting from trying to figure out what you do with the rest of your life when you're not even 40 years old yet and you have such a debilitating disease that you can't leave your home most of the time. I don't find resources for people like me that live out in suburban areas that can't get to places like McGee, who has support groups, or those seem to be more directed in big cities, not further out. So people like me just get stuck and isolated with no concept of what to do.
Oh, boy, your comment raises lots of questions first that I think we have to ask before we can begin to give you any answer. First, Guy, I can see from the look on your face you got some medical questions as soon as Russell said my back started breaking.
Yeah, so is this that you have a lot of disc disease and it is a painful condition? Is that what you're talking about, that it's breaking, or do you have an underlying...
Yeah. I have a few herniated discs that ruptured, and then I also had degenerative disc disease that I was unaware of, so they couldn't actually fuse any of the discs at this point.
So,
because it's degenerating so fast.
Are you able to ambulate, or are you in a wheelchair, walker?
At this point, my walking has been debilitating, you know, month by month at a time, and I'm trying to do alternative medical pain management, like trying the new Butrans patches, things that are the non-traditional methods for pain management to try to prolong the surgeries. But I don't have any prognosis to ever get out of being permanently disabled, just that it's just going to get worse and worse.
So, roughly, where do you live?
Currently, I live out in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, across from Philadelphia, but I'm unable to travel more than about 10 minutes from my home.
Because?
I can't really drive too far anymore because the neuropathy that's being caused from the nerve damage in my leg, I'm not really supposed to be operating cars. The pain medicine they put you on, they don't want you driving.
Okay. All right. Well, you're raising a lot of medical and rehab issues that, you know, I would like to address off the air with you. I don't know if Guy Fried, you would like to chat with Russell off the air also. But I want to talk about your mind here. So how is your mind?
It started out great. I was a positive fighter when this all started, very enthusiastic. And, you know, after it's been about 13 months of treatment now, it's thinning down. You know, now when the doctors ask you, you know, do you want something to deal with depression or whatever, you know, my answers always used to be immediately no. And now I consider it more and more because the depression just keeps growing the more isolated I get. I mean, you don't hear from friends anymore or family, and it gets very rough.
And Russell, I can't feel your pain, but I can understand somewhat. When I first started using the wheelchair, it was isolating. I was fortunate to have Dan and my friends, some of whom have fallen away, but I think the resource, I don't know how realistic it is for you, but I was able to find a support group to speak with other people. You know, that's how Dan and I met, who had multiple sclerosis, who could understand what we were going through. And I don't know if you've reached out to see if there is some support that way or an online community. I'm not sure if that would help you.
There is. There are online communities. Russell, I strongly encourage you to get involved with the Christopher and Dana Reeve webpage. That's a great community, and it's just a great resource. I know the MS Society has an office in Cherry Hill, and they're a tremendous resource. And they can, you reach out to them, and they can be responsive to you. I also want to mention that there is intimate relationship between pain and depression, so that pain can trigger depression. Depression makes pain worse. So please don't hesitate to take antidepressants. And there are some antidepressants that are also good for pain also. Finally, for your alternative, they're not so alternative anymore, these so-called alternative treatments. Acupuncture has a good track record for pain, as does mindfulness meditation. And there are programs online, meditation programs online, that are specifically geared to pain. I think Jon Kabat-Zinn has a meditation program that's specifically geared to pain. So those are my thoughts. And if you want to follow up, reach out to us on the webpage, and either I'll follow up or Dr. Fried will. Okay, I wish you the best, Russell, isolation can be life threatening. Too much isolation. I want to bring on Jessica Keenan Smith. Finally, you've been waiting patiently on the phone for us. I want to thank you for being on the air with us today, Jessica.
No, thank you for including me.
So you've got a blog called Living Well with Epilepsy. You were diagnosed when you were 12 or 13.
Yep, the summer between 7th and 8th grade.
That's a critical year for all kids. It's when you develop these secondary sex characteristics. It's, when you're, all kids are the most ashamed around that time. What happened? And what was it like?
It's sort of a critical point in puberty. It's when your body goes through a lot of major hormonal changes, and for some people, it's that hormonal changes it's too much for your body, and your seizure threshold is to a point where those seizures just simply break through because of the hormonal changes.
And what happened to you on the inside, Jessica? What was it like?
There was quite a bit that happened.
Yeah, this young girl. What happened to her?
I think it was a very hard time. It took a couple of years to find a combination of medication that worked to control my seizures. I had to find not only a combo of meds that worked to control the seizures, but also that had minimal side effects. And it is fairly common for that process to take a couple of years. And so during that time, I'm going through 7th, 8th, freshman, sophomore, junior year of high school. I was not a happy person at the time.
How did it affect the way you felt about yourself?
Thankfully, I have a great family, very supportive. My sisters were really young at the time. They were 8 and 10 years younger than me. So they didn't quite know what to make of the whole thing, but they're still extremely supportive of me. And, I had a really good group of friends who were still, somewhat in touch.
What's that like? Tell me about the friends, the relationships, and what it did for you.
Well, my parents didn't try to hide my epilepsy. They didn't try to hide it from family. I grew up in Boston, Irish Catholic, fairly traditional family, and, every Ben Affleck, Matt Damon Boston movie that you could think of, that was my family. And, so it wouldn't go without question for us to hide this kind of thing, but my parents decided to be honest and forthright and just talk about it.
So they didn't feel great shame. Perhaps you didn't either.
Maybe they did feel great shame, but they didn't express that to me.
Yeah.
And they didn't hide it from school either. And they brought me to support groups. My mom tried to get me in touch with other kids that had epilepsy. They made sure that we talked about it with my other friends' families. Everybody talked about it with everybody, talked about it with everybody. And I have to say my parents drove that.
So I've got an unanswerable question for you. What's it like to live with epilepsy?
For me, it's one way. For the next person, it's very different.
We'll start with you.
For me, through my 20s and 30s, I put it off as though it was, quote unquote, no big deal. But then I had a child, got into my 40s. Things with my body became a little bit more complicated, and I realized, wow, having this chronic illness is a little bit more complicated. It's not the no big deal that I thought it was. It affects my bone density. It affects my vision. It affects, how well I sleep. It affects everything. It's head to toe. It's systemic. And if you just take that on, sort of to the nth degree for people whose seizures are not controlled, there are people who are having hundreds of seizures a day, whereas mine have been controlled for over 13 years.
You've answered my question, and you've done a beautiful job with it. So I listened to this, and I wonder, which is going to sound strange coming from a quadriplegic, but how do you live with this? You sound alive and energized and creative and dedicated. So what got you to this point? And all you can do is conjecture here.
I'm lucky enough to have married a wonderful man. I'm lucky enough to have a happy, healthy 13-year-old. And, I have a great family. I have a passion project that I work on, livingwellwithepilepsy.com, that I work on night and day. My day job is in neurology. I'm the Director of Education and Research for the American Neurological Association. So I've been able to mesh my passion in my day and night.
I looked at your blog, and you talk an awful lot about stigma.
In fact, I've just brought somebody on who's in her 20s, actually maybe just 19, who's dedicated to writing about stigma.
Stigma is a big deal with epilepsy.
It is, and it has a long history.
Guy, stigma is a big deal with MS, with spinal cord injury, with closed head injury.
Stigma is huge, and I think it's the balance of the names of things, the society images of things, but our image for ourselves, whether we stigmatize ourselves. And I think that this young lady's doing a great job of kind of looking at things and really adapting to really thrive.
I've got to tell you both, or all four of you, that shortly after my accident, some 30 years ago, I was on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, and I'm driving down, and I look over to my left, and I see a guy in a wheelchair. And I just said to myself, look at that poor guy over there. And then I realized that was my own reflection.
Every time I hear someone say that a friend has been diagnosed with MS or a family member, my initial reaction is, oh, that poor person.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but I'm living with multiple sclerosis, and I'm living very well, thank you very much. But absolutely think,
oh,
that poor person.
All right, now hold off a minute here. All of you, all of us, we are blessed to have full robust life. However, we all suffer in our own ways. We have both. Yes, I know.
Life is not perfect. It's not pretty.
Well, for anyone.
Well, I think you just think everybody's got something, and it's just like, why should mine be deemed worse than others? And there's other people that would kill to have my problems, so I don't ever worry about that.
Yeah, yeah. Good point. The comparison thing always gets you into trouble. Guy, you want to say something quick before
I'm just
a break.
Thinking of the Nietzsche line of that which does not kill us makes us strong. Right. And there are certain benefits to having some problem and then overcoming some problem. One is absolutely stronger to take on other issues.
Right.
You become strong in body and soul, and you're able to move forward. So that's what, as a treating physician, that's what you always want from the patient, to really make them strong, to really beat up some issue and attack it and do well, so you can see the strengths out there.
And personally, I have found that my strength only came when I got comfortable with my weakness and no longer ashamed of it. We've got to take a break. We're talking with Jennifer and Dan Digman, who both of whom have MS. Jessica Keenan Smith is founder and managing editor of the blog Living Well with Epilepsy. And of course, Dr. Guy Fried is here in the studio with me. He's the chief medical officer at McGee Rehabilitation Hospital. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and boarding options is dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only contribute to their class communities, but the community as a whole. Taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering campus tours on March 25th and April 29th at 9 a.m. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
Supporting WHYY, Caring Friends Home Care, a nonprofit Quaker-based organization, provides in-home care. Services include home care aides, meal preparation, dressing, hygiene, light housekeeping, and more. With hourly or live-in care, clients receive services while remaining in their own homes. Clients living in long-term care communities can receive additional support. Details at caringfriendshomecare.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about living with that devastating diagnosis that we first get, or any diagnosis that tells us we're going to have to live with this or some variant of this for the rest of our lives. We've got a lot of callers waiting to join the conversation. So let's go right to the phones. Let's start with Mike on line three. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Okay. What can we do for you, Mike?
Well, what I'm dealing with isn't my own physical problem. It's dealing with grief. 3 years ago, I lost my 10-year-old daughter unexpectedly to a cancerous brain tumor. And when you deal with grief, especially soon after you lose a child, obviously you're dealing with it for the rest of your life, but you're also dealing with a lot of mental, and it can be physical, physical issues that you're dealing with. And this is something that does get better for most people in time, but it is something that you do live with for the rest of your life. Now, it's not MS, or it's not any other debilitating disease that happened to you, but it did happen to your child.
Yeah, it's a big hole in your heart that doesn't go away. You're right. And
no.
There's always scar tissue there, and I don't think you would ever want it to go away.
No. What I've learned over 3 years now, my first year or 2 years were really bad, and almost incapacitated, difficulty just going out of the house and going to the supermarket. But something happens, and everybody's different, but you eventually figure out how to honor your daughter or your son,
right.
Ways to keep their spirit alive, and you try to learn live. You try to learn to live with it.
What are you doing, Mike, to honor your daughter? Do you mind giving us her name?
Her name is Abby.
Abby.
We've done a lot of things. First, when I started to recover, I reached out to my Facebook people, my friends, my real friends, as well as my virtual friends, and then kind of reached out and started talking more and more about what happened. And then I created a page for her called Abby's Light on Facebook, where a lot of people follow her life, honor her life. That kind of turned into her legacy, which her legacy is kindness. And I live in Bucks County. And on her birthday, we had the county proclaim her birthday as Random Acts of Kindness Day. And through that and through other ways of getting out the word, people have donated thousands of dollars and have done things for people. And it just helps. It helps keep her in a relationship with you, keeps your spirit going. And for people that have lost a child, it takes time to be able to do that. But I think that's a great way in order to...
So,
make it less raw.
So let's see if we can expand your Facebook page. What's that name again?
If you're on Facebook, it's called Abby's Light, as in a light bulb, L-I-G-H-T.
Well, there you go. Mike, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm so sorry to hear about your loss. And, hopefully we'll get more people interested in Abby's Light.
I appreciate that. Thank
sure.
you. And it's kind of for people that lost their child. It will, hopefully help show them that there are ways to, honor their child.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Mike.
You're welcome.
We'll take some more calls. We'll start with Lily on line one. Lily?
Hello? Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. I want to echo a lot of the things that Jessica said earlier, because I also have epilepsy, and I wasn't diagnosed until I was 19, but I had started having symptoms around 12 or 13, so the same time that Jessica was diagnosed, and it was. Very frustrating because what I was having were what I now know to be simple partial seizures, where I would have these experiences where I would get a ringing in my ears and a bitter taste in my mouth and a tingling sensation and just all these like small things, and it was incredibly frustrating because I couldn't put my finger on what they were.
Lily,
and they
were
really
especially
leading.
Difficult to diagnose.
Lily, tell us
yes.
How you're functioning now.
I am doing okay. It's in the last couple of years since I was my seizures were more or less under control for a while when for about 3 years after I was diagnosed, more or less. But in the last 2 years, I've been in graduate school. And since I was in graduate school, I've had a lot more grand mal seizures. And it's been a lot harder to keep them under control. And I keep having to tweak my medications all the time.
Stress is, I would imagine, not real good for anyone with a seizure.
Yeah, and it tends a lot of times to be when stress is over, which it can be also very frustrating in its own way.
Go on.
But I've been pretty lucky in that, first of all, when I started, for a long time, my symptoms were, as I said, relatively mild. But I've been really lucky in graduate school because I was... in public health. I got a master's in public health, and that is a department that is extraordinarily understanding when it comes to chronic illness.
I would hope so. But
yes.
So I, I, and, appreciate your call, but you know what I was hearing, and Guy, I want you to pick up on this, was, you know, the potential for despair that, you know, we all experience on occasion.
It problems happen, and we have choices in life. So you have those. You could go left to despair, or right to graduate school, or to dig yourself out, as you did. And I certainly admire the choices that you've made to go get your master's in public health to learn. It's like the young lady that we have on who's doing the blog on epilepsy. You're kind of delving into it, learning, becoming an expert in this, helping yourself as you're helping others. I mean, there's certainly a healing quality to doing that, and that all helps us dig out of that choice for despair. Despair is that learned helplessness of, like, I can't do anything, no one can do anything, nothing magical is going to happen, I'm going to sit down and just be stuck with this.
You know, I say very often that the hunger to be known exceeds the hunger to be loved. And when you talk about that sense of isolation or despair, it's a feeling that nobody in this world can ever understand us again. And to a certain level, that's true. You know, I sit here in my wheelchair. There's millions of quadriplegics out there, but nobody can understand my quadriplegia and my experience. But when I talk about what I've experienced just from the perspective of my heart and soul, despair, fear, terror, frustration, anger, joy, love, hatred, that's my experience of being a quadriplegic. What's your experience of being a grown-up man, Guy? Have you had those experiences?
Oh, certainly. You get the despair, you get the choice, you get the whatever. I mean, at school can be very driven, or making the choices, or going on and pushing forward when you're tired. It can be very difficult. I think that understanding oneself or seeking outside counseling can be extremely helpful in keeping us going forward in our own lives.
And just as important, and sometimes more important, being connected with our fellow humans who understand and tolerate vulnerability, ours and theirs.
Absolutely. I think one of the key equations to that resiliency that we're looking for is that ability to network out there, network with God, network with the peer group, network with the support group out there, network with the internet. It's some sort of networking out there, so you're less alone.
Even networking in a department store, when you reach up and say to somebody, could you please help me get this dress down? And that's a human connection.
It is, and if you don't ask, it's sometimes difficult for people to guess, because they don't know.
Right.
People are afraid
of
helping.
Right. Well, unfortunately to everyone, we're out of time. I want to tell a story here, though, before I let all of you go. 3 years ago, we heard from another blogger, Andrea Collins Smith. Her blog, Punk Rock Mommy, told her story, a wife and mother of six, while she battled stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer. The first time I met Andrea, she had on her turban covering her bald head from chemotherapy and the biggest, most beautiful smile I think I'd ever seen. I loved her that day, and I told her so. We invited her to be on the show later. It was a powerful, intimate, and very tender hour. At the end, I knew I would probably never see my friend again. Let's listen to how we concluded the show.
I think that everyone should be doing a lot more forgiving and a lot more accepting and a lot more of embracing of their children, and, you know, forgetting that there's all this other stuff going on that seems so important. You know, your bills and your dishes and all of that are not as important as sitting down with your loved ones and spending time with them. Everyone should be doing that. Because we keep thinking we're going to put off life until this time when it's more convenient, and then you don't have one anymore. So it's time to start living.
Andrea lived every minute of every day. Andrea and I stayed in touch via cell phone. And one day in the early spring, as she was becoming very weak and frail, a friend of hers offered to take her and her children to Ocean City to sit on the beach. And with a great deal of assistance, she was helped onto the beach and sat on a little beach chair, watching her children play in the sand. That's when her phone rang, and it was me on the other end. And I asked her how she was, and she said she told me what she was doing, and then she paused, as if drinking in everything. And she said, "You know, Dan, I think today is the best day of my whole life." And indeed, it was. That day was the best day of my life also. She died a couple of weeks later. I want to thank Jennifer and Dan Digman for sharing their personal stories of MS with us, Jessica Keenan-Smith on her insight into epilepsy. And you can find a link to their blogs on our website. And this other information we got, we've got that guest whose daughter died, and that's also going to be on our website. You can get involved in helping him. And most of what we want, more than anything, is just to connect with us. We're just humans. And what helps all of us, whether we have a disability or not, is a human connection, eye contact, ability to tell our story, and our ability to hear yours. And I believe deep in my heart, not only will that make you and me better people, I believe that'll make the world a better place. So that's my most fervent wish for you, for us, and for all of us. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Email us at voices@whyy.org. My webpage is drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Zakiya Gibbons is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. Oh, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, please listen to what Andrea Collins Smith said and enjoy your week, my friends.
Here and now.